You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about the legal problems of presidents and their associates. Because all presidents have legal problems, but some have more legal problems than others. My co-host is Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney and a former federal prosecutor. He writes the Popehat Report on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had an interesting Memorial Day weekend at a far-right conference in Dallas called the For God and Country Patriot Meetup. Flynn received an audience question about the recent military coup in Myanmar.
I want to know why what happened in Myanmar can't happen here.
No reason. I mean, it should happen here. No reason. But that's right.
So I certainly understand why people are alarmed by this statement from a sometime close associate of the former president in this environment where you have a lot of Americans who have bought into this conspiracy theory that the election was stolen. Did Michael Flynn break the law here? Because I've seen a lot of people alleging that he broke some sort of law by saying that we ought to have a coup like they had in Myanmar.
So, well, actually, it was Myanmar, Josh, which
Myanmar.
I believe is a peaceful nation.
That's north of San Diego, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
I think Tom Cruise rode a motorcycle there. So, Flynn, and for the record, Flynn is now claiming that he didn't say what he clearly said. He's trying to sort of retcon his words by changing emphasis and saying he was saying there was no reason that this sort of thing should happen here, which is clearly from the tape, not what he said. So likely he did not commit a federal crime. The reason is a lot of people are saying that this is incitement, but it's not incitement because it's not likely and intended to cause imminent lawless action. So if he had said, "You're right, let's do it now, go home, get your guns, meet me here, and we're marching over to the nearest Democratic congressman's office and taking it over," okay, that's incitement because it's imminent. This was talking about maybe something should happen in the indefinite future. That doesn't meet the Brandenburg versus Ohio test for what incitement is, which is intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action. Some people, actually quite a few people, are saying that it's a violation of something called the Smith Act, which is a 1940 law that was used against a lot of communists in the 40s and 50s. And it basically says it's illegal to advocate a violent overthrow of the government. And if you looked just at the text of the law, you would probably say, yeah, okay, well, it does seem to violate it. But the thing is, the Supreme Court recognized repeatedly that the Smith Act is not constitutional as written. That it is limited by these First Amendment principles, that only advocacy which is intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action can violate the law. So first the Supreme Court cut it back in a case called Yates in 1957, said only when the speech was enough to cause a clear and present danger. Then later it changed that rule in Brandenburg in 69 and said basically inciting speech, if that's your theory, then it has to be intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action. So that's a long way to say no, Josh. It wasn't a violation of federal law. The trickier question is the military angle.
Right. Yeah. So this is another thing I've seen people saying. Even Congresswoman Elaine Luria, who's a Democrat who represents the Hampton Roads region of Virginia, which is a huge naval area. She's herself a former naval commander. She says that Flynn's remarks border on sedition, that their conduct on becoming an officer. And she says that those are things that could be tried under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. She's saying that you could court-martial Michael Flynn, who is a retired military officer, because even though he's retired, he's subject in some way to the laws of the military. Is that right?
It's not clear. So it's clear that the military could court-martial him if he were still a general and he did this, and probably would. And it's even clear that if he had done this while he was still an officer and then retired and then they found out about it, they could yank him back and court-martial him. What's not clear is how the Constitution applies to post-retirement conduct by someone who is in the military. The military for a while has somewhat aggressively said that it can go after people if they were in the military and are still getting a pension or anything else where they technically could be recalled. Their view is still under military jurisdiction. However, that's tended to be used in really extreme cases. The one that nearly got to the Supreme Court was about a rape. And it has not been used against speech. So recently, the Supreme Court declined to take on a case that would resolve this. That is, whether or not once you leave the military, if you commit a crime, the military can haul you back in and try you there. And there's a pretty good argument that it would be unconstitutional to extend that power to the military. And one district court has found that. You might remember Steve Vladek was our guest host with me one week when you were away, back when we thought that Trump might declare martial law and we had to figure out what that meant. So he is litigating that case, and if anyone's going to win it, it would be him. So we don't know. But aside from whether it's constitutional, there's a separate issue of whether they would try. And most of the people I've talked to who are in the military and know military command think the answer is no. Because Department of Defense likely wouldn't want to make something like this a test case. In other words, if you're going to be testing the proposition that you can prosecute people in military courts for post-military conduct, you're not going to reach out and do it over political speech, something highly controversial and politically incendiary. So it seems very unlikely that Department of Defense would decide to go after this and use this as a test case of the proposition when it's so controversial and when, you know, this is pretty much the worst case for them to convince the Supreme Court that they ought to be able to do this. Because if they could do it to Flynn for this, there's no reason they couldn't do it to former members of the military who, you know, are highly critical and disrespectful to the President of the United States, who's the commander-in-chief. And technically, that would be a violation. If they were in uniform still, they could go get court-martialed for that. So the free speech context makes it something that I think is highly unlikely they will try. There's a lot of wish-casting of the sort that you and I are familiar with from the last 3 or 4 years. Oh, you know, some prosecutors are going to write in and save us from these bad people. And right now, the imagined heroes are military prosecutors. But I think it's unlikely.
I'm trying to understand why it would be the military's business to prosecute somebody like this simply because they once served in the military. I mean, I guess you say he could theoretically be recalled. And the military does have this option in a lot of situations to tell people who have retired from the military that they have to come back to service for some reason. But they wouldn't do that with Flynn for a number of reasons, not just that he's crazy. I mean, it's also he was a general and he's of retirement age. He would not be recalled. So there's no real interest from the government in monitoring his behavior or controlling his behavior than that of any other prominent ex-official who was not in the military, right? Like, it doesn't seem like substantively there would be any good reason why Michael Flynn should be subject to military prosecution for this when if he were a retired State Department official, he would not be subject to that. So is that, where would the constitutional grounding for that come from? Obviously, the government has certain abilities to restrict the speech of its own employees that don't apply to the general public. And there are reasons why you would say that people who are in the military are not supposed to say certain critical things about the government, let alone that it ought to be overthrown. But I don't understand how you would even argue in court that the government had a good reason to be able to prosecute him in a military court for this.
Well, the argument would be in two steps. One step would be that the relevant statutes about military justice can be read to extend this far, to say that you can court-martial somebody who is, you know, hypothetically still on the hook for coming back to military service for things they said after they left military service. The constitutional argument would be that generally courts have given very broad deference to the military and seen it as something that sort of acts outside the normal constitutional bounds. You generally can sue for very few things that happen to you when you're in the military. You have dramatically limited constitutional rights.
Right, deference as regard to its treatment of its own members, you mean?
Exactly, and that's where the analogy breaks down, is that the limiting principle on this big asterisk to the Constitution is that it only applies while you're in the military. If suddenly this same principle applied to, you know, every veteran in Congress, for instance, or every veteran who ever wanted to run for president and badmouth the current commander-in-chief in the course of doing so, then that's a whole different ballgame. And I'm not sure that the Supreme Court would be willing to extend this huge deference given to the military that far, because it really isn't a really good justification for hauling someone back in, other than this general sense of absolute disgust and repulsion that someone who held, was a general and was a national security advisor would say something so completely outrageous. The feeling that, you know, he had a real duty that went much higher and more should be expected of him. But that's not really a constitutional principle. It's more of a emotive and philosophical one.
As you noted, Flynn has been denying that he said the thing that he said. But Maggie Haberman, the reporter for The New York Times, who covered the Trump White House in great detail, she says that former President Trump has been telling people that he expects to be reinstated as president by August. And that's why he's been paying such close attention to this bizarre so-called audit that's going on in Maricopa County, Arizona, that he thinks that this is all going to come and show that the election was stolen, and then they will then give the presidency back to him. And so I don't know, in his mind, who would do that. You would think that you would need a military role in that, because clearly the courts are not going to order that. And he's, you know, eventually became very dejected seeing that the courts were not going to do that. And so, obviously it's not a crime to believe that there is going to be a coup that is going to install you in power. But the former president is presumably having conversations with people about this. What would he have to start saying before that would become some sort of conspiracy crime?
Well, he would have to make an agreement. So the heart of conspiracy is always agreement, an agreement by two or more people to commit a specified crime. So the day some military people come to Trump and say, we will take control of Congress with whatever military unit, and you come back and we will declare you president, and he says, yes, let's do that, then he's committed seditious conspiracy. So the time they actually agree to take action like that, it's a crime. But it's not a crime for him to hope or bluster about it or wish for it or that type of thing, unless he reaches the point where, again, he is instructing people to do things. He's telling them, go draw up plans for a capture of all members of Congress, or, you know, go, you know, collect weapons to be used or something like that. Or if he's exhorting people in a way that is incitement, that is likely to cause imminent lawless action, you know, go do this right now. Until he does that, it's just Trump being Trump. And it's appalling, but it's not a crime.
And it's also not a crime, I assume, to agree with other people to do things that are not illegal that you incorrectly believe will lead to a coup that installs you as president. If he encouraged people to go out and make statements of the sort that Flynn made, that I think we just covered, it was not an illegal statement, whatever else it was, or if you're trying to get these, you know, these bizarre fake recounts done that you hope, you believe correctly or incorrectly, will produce results saying that the election was stolen from you, the mere fact that you think that that may lead to eventually somehow the military installing you as president, that doesn't make it a conspiracy to commit a coup, because the coup part is missing.
That's right. You've got to agree to do the illegal thing. It's the difference between, you know, go out and argue that we ought to be able to move cocaine from state to state and get the cocaine ready for when people agree. You got to get the cocaine ready for it to drift into the criminal category.
The Biden administration is actually seeking to dismiss a lawsuit over the mistreatment of protesters in Lafayette Park last spring. This is when the former president had the park cleared forcibly and went and held up a Bible outside the church, and they sprayed tear gas that they've now the DC police have admitted that they sprayed tear gas, even though the government was denying that a year ago. But the Biden administration is essentially defending the conduct of the government under the Trump presidency, saying that a paramount responsibility of federal law enforcement is to protect the president, and then also saying that the lawsuit is moot because Trump isn't president anymore and we're not going to do this again and we've reopened Lafayette Park. Does that work? I don't understand why there would be mootness here, because maybe it's moot. You don't need injunctive relief. You don't need to tell them to stop doing things that they're not doing anymore. But wouldn't you still be looking for damages for what was done?
Sure. So there's a sort of a jumble of different arguments going on here. The mootness argument is basically, yes, there's no need. The court has to issue an injunction telling us not to do that because we're a new administration. And of course, we're not going to do that. Of course, the notion that a Democratic administration won't use force and violence in the course of limiting protests is not backed up by history. I don't think it's a good argument. The other arguments are really actually, in a way, throwing the Trump administration under the bus. As you point out, they're now admitting, contrary to the messaging of the Trump administration and its flunkies in the media, that there was tear gas. The big message before was there was no tear gas. You made that up. The other thing they're admitting is that they're making the connection between moving the people out of the park and Trump going there. So before, the narrative was, no, we didn't sweep people up out of the park to clear the room for this photo op, which would be outrageous. We cleared the people out of the park because they were a threat, and then we did the photo op. But their narrative now very much admits that the purpose of rousting these people and using the force they did was so that Trump could walk over and hold up the Bible in front of that church. And that's pretty damaging to the Trump administration, to the extent anything is ever damaging to the Trump administration. The rest of it, some of their arguments have to go to who can be sued. So they're arguing that Trump and other higher members can't be sued for undertaking their duties to instruct the Secret Service and federal police to protect themselves. And they're not really saying that no particular officer can be held liable for any particular act of violence or excessive force in the course of doing it. They're just saying, no, if you have someone, a higher up official with the administration who says, you know, make sure you clean this park, that's protected, that's immunized because it's part of protecting the president in general.
But wait, so I mean, you say it throws the Trump administration under the bus because it changes the narrative and admits certain things that we've frankly already known for a year. But doesn't it also protect Trump and his associates by taking the position that they shouldn't be sued? Is it surprising that the Biden DOJ would take that position?
Oh, it sure does do that, and it's absolutely not surprising. And I've been actually, honestly, a little temperamental over this, over these big, extravagant expressions of shock and dismay that the Justice Department would do what the Justice Department always does. So the Justice Department is not institutionally going to roll over and say, because we hated the last guys, then yes, we're going to agree to widen the circumstances under which you can sue the government. That's not what they do. They're always looking institutionally to narrow the places where you can sue the government because, first of all, they know that it's going to happen to them, and second of all, they have this institutional interest in protecting the institutions. So it's not even a little surprising to me. They do not want to stick it to Trump or Trump's minions as much as they want to protect the institutions and protect the relatively narrow circumstances under which you can sue the government. So that's the way it's always going to work.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about thumb-headed henchmen Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow. I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Ken, you know June is Pride Month, right?
Yes, I've heard that.
And we have an LGBT inclusion milestone to report here on All the President's Lawyers. Judge J. Paul Etkin in the Southern District of New York, who was the first openly gay man named to the federal bench when Barack Obama appointed him in 2011, he is now the first openly gay, long-suffering federal judge dealing with this cast of characters that we have on this show. He's overseeing the trials of Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, and he's also dealing with the search of Rudy Giuliani's office. He has agreed that he's going to appoint a special master who will decide what files in Giuliani's office are privileged and which ones the government can look at. This mess is all on his desk and in his courtroom.
Well, it's the same as marriage, Josh. Everyone should suffer the same.
Let's start with Lev Parnas, because we used to talk about Lev Parnas a lot, and he's gotten a little bit out of the spotlight on this show, and I want to fix that this week. So we've had this surprising search of Giuliani's home and Giuliani's office and various other attorneys, including Victoria Tensing, and Lev Parnas wants to see materials from these searches, saying that they're going to help with his argument that he was politically prosecuted because the hope of the Trump administration was to interfere with the House probe of Trump's Ukraine dealings by prosecuting Lev Parnas. What would he be looking for? It would be that Giuliani would be talking with other people about how they're going to screw Lev Parnas as part of their effort to protect the former president?
Well, yeah, it's an odd argument because clearly going after Lev Parnas involved putting more of a spotlight on Rudy Giuliani. So it would be a very stupid thing to do for Rudy Giuliani, which clearly does not exclude it from possibility. So he's talking about selective prosecution, the notion that you can't be singled out for prosecution by the government for illegitimate purposes, for instance, your speech. So what he would have to do is demonstrate that he was singled out for a protective reason, in this case, his political ideology or speech, and that other similar people who did the same sort of thing weren't prosecuted for it. So this evidence could hypothetically, maybe if Rudy put things down in writing, which he is of course dumb enough to do, show that he was singled out for politics, but he would still probably have trouble showing that similarly situated people were not prosecuted for the same thing because, you know, the government's been on somewhat of a binge of these prosecutions.
Well, I mean, but also like the most similarly situated person in the world, Igor Fruman, is being prosecuted for this. And it was this whole drama. They got arrested. And originally the thought was that Parnas and Fruman were going to be loyal to Trump and to Giuliani. And Fruman, by all accounts, stayed that way and stayed with these attorneys who were associated with the former president. And Parnas struck out on his own and decided that he was going to try to be like Michael Cohen and make his bet on that standing up to Donald Trump would be his ticket out of his legal jeopardy. But so he'd already been arrested at that point. So how could he be selectively prosecuted if the behavior for which he says he was being selectively prosecuted happened after he was already arrested, and his co-defendant, who did not do the behavior that he says he's being punished for, is being similarly prosecuted?
Well, you know, that's a good point, and the theory doesn't make a lot of sense on a lot of levels. I don't think it's a theory that's likely to succeed, but, you know, when you're looking down the barrel of all these federal charges, you start groping around for anything that might give you some sort of defense theory or some sort of leverage against the government, perhaps, to get a better outcome. So certainly anyone in that circumstance would probably be hoping to get their hands on some of that Giuliani stuff, because really, who knows what Giuliani wrote down about this? It could be horrifying, and you could use it just to, you know, create a confusing shit show in the case, even if it's not a legal defense.
We've learned more about materials that federal prosecutors have seized in this Giuliani investigation, email and iCloud accounts of certain Ukrainian figures related to this whole mess, also historical and prospective cell site information related to Rudy Giuliani and Victoria Tensing. We learned about this because there was a redacted document filed that CNN figured out that even though there was black bars over certain text, you could just highlight it and copy and paste it out of there, put it in a new document, and you could read what was under the black bars. So first of all, just a PSA to everyone. If your document is in a PDF format and you put a black bar over it in the PDF format and then do not save it as a new image, then the text under the bar is still there and people can still look at it in the way that CNN did. So please stop doing that. This is not the first time that this has happened. But Ken, like, how does this happen? Is that, do we know, is this a mistake that was made by prosecutors or that was made somewhere else along the line in the legal process?
Well, Josh, first of all, as you probably know, everyone who understood what you just said didn't need to be told, and everyone who needed to be told didn't understand what you just said. So the government frequently lags behind on this type of thing. The government always is behind on tech, and particularly the sort of just day-to-day tech that you use in the office as opposed to the fancy, you know, parabolic mics and things like that. And this sort of thing happens all the time. And sort of office laziness or carelessness shows us stuff all the time. You might remember a few years ago, we found out about some of the charges against Julian Assange of WikiLeaks because some hapless AUSA reused a document from the Assange case in a different case and forgot to change all the names. So this type of mistake happens all the time. It's the governmental equivalent of the accidental reply all. It happens. God willing, it won't happen to you, and you just, you know, pray for the best. They could do better with OPSEC, though, certainly. In terms of what do we learn from it, I don't know if it's a lot we didn't suspect before. It definitely suggests that the ongoing investigation is centered around not just Giuliani's efforts on behalf of the Ukraine, but specifically the intersection of the Ukraine's interests and Trump's interest, that being going after Hunter Biden and thwarting Joe Biden. So the people who are being investigated here, the records being sought, suggest that they are looking at people close to that intersection, people who were involved or connected to the efforts to get Ukraine to announce an investigation of Hunter Biden.
Does the fact that this information became public cause any sort of problem for the investigation or the prosecution? Presumably, they were redacting this information for a reason. Like, is it a problem that the people whose email accounts were accessed now know that their email accounts were accessed? I guess we're talking about conduct that happened in the past, so I don't know that we would worry as much here as we might in some other circumstance that the people who are being investigated or surveilled will change their behavior because they know about that.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, the places where you really worry about this stuff is like, again, a drug operation or something like that, where they're going to, you know, shut down the meth lab and move, something like that. Here, where it's already happened, they already have the records. And plus, if any of these people have a room temperature IQ, they already know that they're in the spotlight. It's probably not actually a meaningful problem. It's just very embarrassing.
Politico reports that certain experts and former prosecutors say that the Manhattan DA's investigation into the Trump Organization may be heading toward a prosecution under New York's Little RICO law. So, Ken, I guess, first of all, what is Little RICO? How does that differ from regular RICO?
Okay, so RICO, you might recall, is this complex, convoluted federal law that you can use to go after organized crime in a very needlessly convoluted way. And a number of states passed so-called little RICO laws, you know, state racketeering laws that you could use to go after criminal organizations and dismantle them. New York has one such law. And again, the purpose of it is to have special types of charges you can bring against organizations that you assert are engaged in ongoing certain types of criminal activity.
So did the Trump Organization do a little RICO?
I think it's unlikely. When you look at Politico's report and a lot of the people saying this, the sourcing is not clear. So, we had people clearly saying there's a grand jury investigation. That's a specific thing. This story is about people speculating, saying, oh, I bet they're doing Little RICO. But that's because Little RICO is treated much like Big RICO. That is, it's used as an emoji or an exclamation point. It's used to convey that the speaker takes this very seriously, and this sure is a bad thing. And we've been hearing about how RICO was going to take down Trump or the Trump organization or the GOP or all this stuff for years now, and it hasn't happened, and I don't think it's going to happen. Again, the thing about New York prosecutors, like federal prosecutors, is that they don't tend to needlessly overcomplicate things. You know, when they went after Manafort, they reused some of the same stuff the feds had already done. Their other pursuits have tended to reflect a relatively straightforward, bare bones type of approach to things. Little RICO, like big RICO, is just a complicated way to go after an organization, and not complicated for good reasons. It's used really, and it's designed for when the nature of the organization, like, you know, a mafia group, is very hard to break into, and you don't have normal types of charges that you can bring against people involved with it. That doesn't seem to be the case here. If New York has developed the type of charges we've been talking about, tax fraud charges, and thinks it can stick it to people, then they're more likely to do it the straightforward way than they are to do it a way that gets big headlines, but then can blow up in your face because it's so hard to prove.
Finally, this week, I want to talk about civil FARA. FARA is the Foreign Agents Registration Act. This is something that people keep running into, including Lev Parnas. If you are lobbying the U.S. government on behalf of a foreign entity, you have to register with the government and say that you're doing that. And so, allegedly, Steve Wynn was involved in 2017 efforts to expel a prominent Chinese businessman who is resident in the United States, who is disfavored by the communist regime in China, and they would like him deported back to China so that they can prosecute him or whatever it is they want to do. And Steve Wynn, who has significant business in Macau, where gambling is legal in China, was alleged to be part of an effort to lobby the Trump administration to do this. And so the Justice Department, according to the Wall Street Journal, is preparing to sue him under the civil FARA statute. We've seen all these criminal FARA charges that get brought. And basically, they want to sue him and make him register as a foreign agent. And so I'm wondering why. If someone has violated FARA, why would you bring a civil action instead of criminal charges? And what does the government get out of the civil action? I don't understand why, if we make Steve Wynn register as a lobbyist, that does something important.
Well, Josh, it's a lot easier to go after people civilly for this sort of thing. Criminal investigations take a lot longer. You have to be ready to go when you charge. You know, the person could insist on a speedy trial. You've got to have your ducks in a row. Civil, is a completely different story. Civil actions, you get to demand discovery from the person you're suing, which you don't get to do with limited exceptions in criminal cases. And the intent requirements are not as high. So to prove that Steve Wynn criminally violated FARA requires a different mental state than simply going in and compelling him to register. So, you know, criminally, to successfully prosecute him, you'd have to show that he knew that this is what he was and this requirement. And to civilly force him to register, you just have to show, okay, this is what you're doing, and that qualifies. So it may be because it's much quicker to do, it's much easier to do, and they're not really gunning for his scalp. They're not looking to put him in jail, but they are looking to embarrass him and make an example of him and force him to register. And they get most of what they're looking for in a civil case.
There is much more we could talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW, or you can send us a question at kcrw.com/ATPL. All the President's Lawyers was produced today by Rebecca Mooney and recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more of All the President's Lawyers.